The regular Thursday beginners meeting of Laguna Al-Anon. My name is Margaret, and I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Margaret.
It's a real privilege and a pleasure to introduce Elsa to you, who is going to speak to you today. Elsa?
We didn't expect that it would be like this today. At least the group didn't. Oh, me. You know, phonetics are a funny thing. And when Bill called me, she said, would you speak it to the group Thursday? And I said, I'd be happy to. And this morning, she called me in a perfect tizzy, poor Bill. Because to speak and to lead to her meant the same thing. So, unfortunately, somebody asked me where I was going to talk next. And I said, well, I'm talking Thursday at the Thursday group at Laguna. And somehow or other it got around. And so a few people came, I guess, to hear a talk, and the rest of you came for a discussion group. So we'll try and work it out so that it's both, if we can. And incidentally, my name is Elsa, and I'm a very grateful, comfortable, happy member of Al-Anon. Hi. It's awfully good to be with you, whether it's a speaker group or a discussion group, doesn't really make too much difference. And you know, the strange part of it was that Bill also said, we had such a good meeting down at the Tuesday night group the other night. And the subject was self-acceptance. And I was thinking on the way down here that almost my entire recovery has been one of learning how to get self-acceptance. And so maybe the two will kind of work together. Let us hope they will anyway. But for the benefit of the newcomer here, I would like to speak to her for a moment, if I may. I am sure that Doris has given her the whole idea of Al-Anon, but I would like to underline the fact that most of us come to this program trying to find out how to get our mates sober. This is our primary object. And when we get here, we find out that we're not there to get our mates sober. We're there to do something about ourselves. Our own attitudes, our own reactions, our own peace of mind, and our own serenity. And that it has really nothing to do with the alcoholic except as an example, because apparently there is very little that any one of us can do to make an alcoholic quit drinking. It's just almost impossible. There are a few cases where alcoholics have been pushed into the program and have stayed, but as a rule, this doesn't really work out too well. So when you can come to see that when you can find your own peace and your own joy and your own comfortable feeling in spite of a practicing alcoholic or anything else that might be going on, people, places, things, circumstances, the whole bit, because we have spent a lifetime, most of us, reacting to what other people say and do, and getting ourselves in trouble along the way. And it's a wonderful sense of freedom when you can come to the point where it doesn't make that much difference what goes on around you and how other people act and react, because they cannot as often, let us say, jar your own serenity. Because you have learned that you have absolutely no power over other people, and that there is only one security when it comes right down to brass tacks, and that's your own relationship with your own idea of God. And when we are dependent upon other people for our peace of mind, we're in trouble, because other people are not going to perform the way we think they should, strangely enough, because we all have ideas, and mostly I think it's been the way we've been brought up. We've been taught a lot of things from the time we were born, practically, that have come down to us from generation after generation after generation back, about how to live and what to do and how to act and the whole bit. And 9 times out of 10, the things we've been taught are wrong. And so this program, to me, is almost more a program of unlearning than it is of learning. Because we have to get rid of, as the big book in AA says, all of our old ideas. Because none of them really work. They just don't work. And if you were like me, during my husband's drinking, I tried everything under the sun that anyone can try to try to get this guy to quit drinking, and nothing but nothing ever worked. And the last 10 years of his drinking was periodic. So there were always sober periods in between these drunks. And during the sober periods, things would begin to straighten out and get calm and even and more or less all right. And then all of a sudden, off he'd go again. And as the years progressed, the sober periods got shorter and shorter and shorter, and the drunks got longer and longer and longer, until the last 5 years was one of complete and utter hell as far as I was concerned and as far as my children were concerned. And I am sure that it was even a worse hell for my husband, because he was caught in the grip of something that he couldn't handle, something that he couldn't do anything about. Now, this man is not a weak man. He's an extremely strong man, and those of you that know him know that he comes on awful strong. He has willpower to beat anything that I have ever seen in my life. And yet willpower does not work in this area. It just simply does not work. Because this is a sickness, and it's a threefold sickness, really. It's a sickness of the soul, when it comes right down to it. Because these people have been looking for answers to living and to life from the time they were little bitty kids. And they never found answers that fitted with their feelings inside. And it's rather difficult for the non-alcoholic to understand the alcoholic, because in my day, for instance, there was no Al-Anon, and there was so little AA in those last 5 years that I didn't know anything about it, even though we had both read the article in the Saturday Evening Post that came out in 1941. So I knew there was a place, something, but I didn't know what it was, really. And I didn't know where to contact it, either. So I continued to do all of the wrong things. And I got myself into such a state of mind and being that I suddenly realized that if I didn't do something about me, that I was going to end up in Patton long before he did. Because I was thinking some of the most insane thoughts and doing some of the most insane things, even to the point of where I wished my husband would die in one of the alcoholic convulsions, of which he had quite a number, and the DTs and all the rest of it. And also, here's another one that, thank God I've learned to laugh at it, or I think it'd kill me with guilt. Because I used to, in the back of my mind, conjure up different ways that maybe I could get rid of this guy and not get found out. Now, this is not sane thinking. And I wonder how many of the rest of you thought the same thing. But the alcoholic is not a very free person when he's drinking, and it's very difficult for us to see that he is doing this against his own will. Because when an alcoholic, either some say he's born an alcoholic, some say he becomes an alcoholic from drinking too much, but at any rate, when an alcoholic crosses over that invisible line from controlled drinking to obsessive drinking, he is helpless, completely helpless. So maybe if we can kind of understand the kind of a grip that he is in and how terribly he suffers, how horribly he hurts, because he is a perfectionist at heart. He is an idealist at heart. And an idealist and a perfectionist, when his own performance is so lousy, has this tremendous hurt inside of him because he is not performing the way he would like to perform, and he doesn't seem to be able to do anything about it. And he knows he's crucifying his family. He knows he's hurting them terribly. And yet, the only release that he knows is to wipe out his mind with alcohol. And this is not easy for the non-alcoholic to understand. And I wish that I had been able to see this when Chuck was drinking, because I think if I had had this program and could have known really what was the matter with the guy, that I would have acted very differently, and it's highly possible that he would have come to AA much sooner than he did, because he read the article in 41, but he did not come until 46. And he was so beaten down and so beside himself and so terribly, terribly sick. His job was gone, his health was gone, his sanity was gone. I was getting a divorce. The works were gone. Money was gone. Everything was gone. And somehow or other, the alcoholics who come to this terrible low, when they finally are able to give up and say, I cannot do this thing myself. I need help. Sometimes they change so abruptly from the arrogance, the terrific arrogance of the alcoholic, to one of complete humility and grab this program and run with it. But there are many, many who come in much before they have reached this low. And the change is more gradual. And that's the reason that one of our do's and don'ts, one of our don'ts anyway, is that we should not be disturbed by the slowness, the apparent slowness of the alcoholic's recovery. But you see, the thing that is so terrific about Al-Anon is that if you can come before the alcoholic comes to AA, you have an opportunity to get yourself in hand, to find, as I said before, your own peace and your own joy in spite of. And if for no other reason, you can at least become an example to the alcoholic, and perhaps he might get very curious by the change in you and wonder just exactly how you did it. And sometimes they get very resentful in the beginning of the fact that you're changing. And I think I know why. At least it's true with me, because misery loves company. Misery sure does love company. And the alcoholic knows exactly how to press every button you possess, how to get every reaction out of you that they can possibly get, so that they can then say, If it weren't for you, I wouldn't have to drink. And they have a built-in excuse for their behavior. And I don't know whether they are conscious of this or not. At least I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say that it is an unconscious thing. It's a natural reaction, I think. A lot of us do exactly the same thing, you know. We retaliate in exactly the same way if we are not awfully careful. I don't like to talk too much about my story, even though there's a need for identification, I am sure. But I know that I did everything wrong during those last 10 years. In fact, I did everything wrong for 20 years. You want to know the truth of it. I hid the bottles, I poured them out, I hid the car keys, I yelled and I screamed and I cried and I begged and I gave him the silent treatment. I think all of you know what that is. The good old silent treatment where you don't speak to them for a week or two on end. And I threatened and threatened and threatened to either kick him out or to leave or to get a divorce and never did anything about it. And I can see now that I was a complete devout coward. I've always been a people pleaser. I had learned early in my high school days as a beginning to put up a front because I was terribly interested in the drama. And I followed it for quite a while. And believe me, in acting, you learn how to put on a front of being completely serene and at ease and be shaking yourself to pieces on the inside. And it's not an easy way to live. It's a very rough way to live because you're always trying to please people. You're always trying to be what you think they want you to be. To say what you think they want you to say. And I remember so well one time before I was married that we had a little foursome that used to go out together. And the boyfriend of my girlfriend said to me one time, "Elsa, you know, men like a woman with opinions." And he said, "Don't always agree with everybody." But you know, I was so stupid I didn't learn. I had to learn this in my later years. And I often say, oh dear, so soon old and so late smart, you know. And it's taken me a long time. But I think I know, and I've told my group this, it's something that I just discovered lately, that one of the reasons why I have been so slow in growth in this program is because I went to AA with my husband for 6 long years before Al-Anon was born. Therefore, I had a sober husband. I had one who had gone to the depths and who had changed almost completely, who had grabbed this program with both hands and just had run with it. So there was peace in our home. And there was apparently no need for me to change. Everything was just going fine. But I had become a complete and utter nothing. I was the shadow of my husband. I followed him around like the good little wife. They never opened her mouth, you know, was afraid to express herself for fear she would be made fun of, which had been going on for quite a few years. You know, it's surprising what they can do to your self-confidence. They can just squash you down and squash you down and squash you down. But I have discovered this, and I wish you would listen to this, because this is something you can take home with you. Nobody, but nobody, ever tears you down for any other reason than to build himself up. And when you can see this, that it is not personally meant, really. The things that these alcoholics sometimes toss at us will not hurt so much because you can realize that they're hurting. They're hurting terribly. And they have to have a whipping boy. And who is the best whipping boy? the person you love the most and that is the closest to you, you see. And one of our girls got a real good gimmick one time that I like to tell about every once in a while, because if you like a visual thing, sometimes it fits in a little better and we remember it a little better if we can sort of see a picture in our mind. She was married to a guy that was still drinking, and it was just about as ugly as anybody can be, and used to accuse her of everything under the sun and call her some pretty lousy names and so forth. And this was destroying her, actually destroying her, because she thought he really meant it. And she heard us talking about this thing that people don't tear you down unless they want to build themselves up. And all of a sudden it occurred to her, well, this is just a bunch of fog balls. They have absolutely no, and I never can remember the word that I want to use. And somebody in the audience always has to prompt me. There's nothing to it. Can't hurt you. Huh?
No substance.
No substance. Why can't I remember that name,
that word?
I never can. It has no substance. And if you can remember that anyone, and you know the funny part of it is, we do the same thing. It's almost the case of you kick me, I'll kick you that much harder. You know, it's a vindictive something or other, you know? And if they hurt us, then we turn around and we hurt them just that much more, and every big fight that Chuck and I ever had was caused by this very thing. And it always started with some little thing that didn't amount to a hill of beans, or it started with the fact that he had accused me of something I hadn't done, or he was criticizing something I had done, and I couldn't stand criticism, and my back here would just raise up, and I would have to defend myself. And, of course, when you start defending yourself, then the thing really starts going. And it will end up in a knockdown, drag-out, terrible, heartbreaking fight. And if you're like me, if I lose my temper, and I must say here, too, that I used to have one of the most vitriolic, horrible tempers that anyone ever had, because I was slow to arouse, but when I did, watch out, because I saw red, and I would say things and do things that I would want to just tear myself apart for afterwards. Cruel things, you know, things that I didn't mean at all, and I had to get rid of this temper. I don't know whether I am, I won't tell you about that either. I just had to get rid of it. I haven't got time. The things that I have had to learn on this program, and I started to tell you why I'm such a slow learner, was because I was not desperate when Al-Anon came into being. I was out there to tell you how to find this very relaxed, very lovely way of life, I thought, you see. So I started the group in my home in Beverly Hills, and I spent about 5 or 6 years running that group, because there was no one around that had been around as long as I had, and I knew all the answers. I'd been listening, you know, for 6 years, and it's awfully easy to find the words, to hear the words, and to be able to hand them to somebody else. And it's awfully easy, too, to see the other fellow's problem. And it's awfully easy to see the other fellow's answer. So you tell them what they need to do and how they need to work and whatnot. And it wasn't until we moved down to Laguna here and I was thrown in a completely new environment, a different set of circumstances, no friends and no meeting, that I was backed up against another wall. You see, I had been backed up against the wall when I sought divorce, because I did not want to get a divorce. I was scared to death. I had never earned my own living in my life, and the thought of having to support my mother and 2 children just frightened the living daylights out of me. So I kept putting it off, and here I was on the fence for 10 long years. Shall I or shan't I? Shall I or shan't I? And never able to make up my mind. And if there's a more uncomfortable situation for anyone to be in, I don't know what it is. Is a fence sitting. Because you get so screwed up in your mind and in your thinking that you're just as crazy as a loon. Just as crazy as a loon. So I can see that every step in growth that I have made has been really when I have been pushed into a corner that I couldn't get out of and I've had to do something about it. If you get desperate enough and if you get uncomfortable enough with yourself, you'll do something about it. But some of us are pretty hard-headed people. I'm a stubborn German, and I'm slow-headed. But to be able to see yourself is something that comes rather it doesn't come easily. It comes hard to be able to see yourself. And it was out of this necessity, this thing that was eaten at my inside, that caused me again to realize that I had to do something about me. And it was with the help of the Monday group, which again started in my home, that I was able finally to see that what was the matter with me was that I wanted everybody's approval. Mostly, I wanted my husband's approval, and I was scared to death of his disapproval. I couldn't stand it. Because to me, his disapproval, you see, was criticism, and I couldn't stand criticism from him. In fact, I couldn't stand it from anybody, but most of all from him. My husband brings up something that I think is rather good. He says resentments don't come first. Rights come first. And when you have rights, you have to defend them. And they become resentments. Because you're on the defensive and you're fighting everybody and everything, you see? So maybe part of my growing up is having to find out that I have no rights, really, in expecting anything from anybody, not even consideration. My whole thing is that I've got to be comfortable with me, regardless of what goes on around me. And it took me a long time. And I finally had to argue with myself a bit and to say to myself, you've heard all your life that the most charming you that you can be is when you are completely yourself. And yet I had never been completely myself. So I started trying to the best of my ability to be myself in the best way that I could. I finally had to say, like old Popeye, I am what I am, and that's all I am, and if it's not good enough, that's just too bad, that's all there is there today. I'm doing the best I can to apply these 12 steps to myself that I can today. And if it isn't very good, I'm sorry, that's all there is there today, but I'm doing the best I can. And to try to get rid of looking for, the expectation for, this approval from my husband, which I was not getting, definitely not getting, even in sobriety. Because he's a man that doesn't say very much. You wouldn't think that if you heard him from the podium, but he doesn't say very much at home. Very difficult for the alcoholic to compliment us or to tell us they love us even. They show it to us in other little funny, strange ways. And if you're missing it, you're missing a lot, believe me, because it's very difficult for them to open up and tell you how they feel inside. Very difficult. But the strange part of it was that I've been talking for years about something that I learned, strangely enough, from him too. That it isn't worthwhile to do something for something. That trading and barter is a lost cause. That we have to change our attitudes to one of doing what we do just because we want to, for free and for fun, because it takes a tremendous load off our shoulders. When you have to do something, you rather resent it. It's having to do it that makes you a little resentful. But if you are doing it for free and for fun with no strings on it, it takes a tremendous load off your shoulders. And also that we have to learn to love for free and for fun with no strings on it. That it no longer is barter, an exchange. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. You know? And this takes a tremendous responsibility off your shoulders and a tremendous load. But I had never connected this with this need for approval. And all of a sudden, it wasn't more than, maybe 4 or 5 years ago that it hit me like a ton of bricks that the reason I needed that approval so terribly was because I wasn't loving for free. It was as simple as that. There were strings on my love. I was expecting a response, a comeback, a pat on the back. Gee, you're wonderful. Wasn't that that's a tremendous meal you cooked. And the funny part of it is that when I quit looking for it, it began to come. This is the funny part of it, because when another person knows that you expect them to appreciate you, they back off. And we do exactly the same thing if we look at it honestly. And so many of us have a way of being awfully good AAs and Al-Anon, out around AA and Al-Anon. And when we walk in our front door, we take off our program just exactly like we take off our overcoat. Many of us do this because it's an old habit pattern. And I've heard it said, too, that this program is an overlaying of an old habit pattern, like a record, you know, with a new one. And pretty soon the old one disappears. And another thing that I've had to learn is to completely get rid of the past. I've had to throw it away, except that I, every once in a while, take a look at it in order to see where I came from and what the growth has been, because it's the only way that I can judge it, because it's all relative. It's all relative. And I think it does us a great deal of good to be able to take a look at the kind of person we were when we first came in, what the situation at home was like, how crazy we were, how upset we were, how quickly we reacted to everything that went on in our household, not only our spouses, but our children. And that be able to see that we have at least made some growth. Some growth. And some of us are slow, and some of us are fast, and some of us are in between. But another thing I've had to learn is to have a good-natured flexibility with myself and to be able to laugh at me. This has helped me more than any one thing I know of. To be able to turn around and look at that foolish, silly, stupid woman and laugh at her and say, thank God for this program. Thank God. Because these 12 steps, now that I'm beginning to apply them to me instead of to you, have an entirely different meaning, you see. And those first three mean a great deal to me. And if you have made a decision in the third step to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him, and you've made as good an inventory as you possibly can, and you shared it with somebody as you do in the fifth step, then you should have become entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. This is what I finally had to come to do and to see first and then to do, really. Because the sixth and seventh steps, they were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And the seventh says, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Now, if we have become completely willing to give up these shortcomings and defects, and if we have faith in this power greater than ourselves, why do we feel that we have to continue to tear ourselves apart and dig and dig and dig for defects of character, beating our breasts and saying, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, which to me is continually looking at and living in the problem. I've heard it said that the more you look at a problem, the bigger it grows, that it's just exactly like watering and fertilizing a weed. It grows out of all proportion. So if you are willing to give up your defects of character, and if you have faith in your higher power to remove them, then you can go on to your amend steps and start doing something for somebody else, for free and for fun, and making what amends you can. And it took me a long time to see where I had to make amends. I thought my husband needed to make amends to me. I was the one that was harmed in this thing. My children were harmed. But you see, I had to finally admit that I had done great harm, not only to my husband, but to my children, by my attitudes and my actions and reactions. Because I was so obsessed with the alcoholic that I couldn't think about anything else. This obsession of ours, I think, is just as great an obsession as the alcoholic's obsession for booze. Many of us get so emotionally involved and so terribly emotional ourselves that we will get into an automobile and drive through stop signs and red lights and drive for hours and hours and never even remember where we've been. And many of us end up in institutions because we have allowed ourselves to fall apart. And that word allowed makes me think of something else, too. When it comes right down to brass tacks, if you will look at it honestly, you will find that all of the things that we think the alcoholic has done to us, we have allowed him to do. Now, I had to forgive myself for what I allowed my husband to do because I was doing the best I knew how according to what I knew then. I know very differently today, very differently. And that's what this program's all about. And it's tremendous what can happen because then you come to that tenth step, continue to take personal inventory. That means daily inventory. And when wrong, promptly admit it. It took me years and years to be able to admit when I was wrong. Because you see, I couldn't stand having anybody think I was less than perfect, you know? And It's pretty horrible, in a way, when you can see yourself exactly as you are. And yet, when you know that you have a group, and you have friends, and you have a way to go to change yourself from the kind of person you don't like to the kind of person that you do like and that you can live with, why get all upset and discombobulated about it? Because, you know, living is a funny thing. Life is life, and it isn't always a bowl of cherries. Things come along in life that sometimes are not very pleasant. I've had quite a few myself since sobriety. But, you see, when you get far enough away from something, you can look back and see where the good was in it. Because if you're as stubborn as I am, and if you're as lazy as I am, when things are going along pretty well, and all of a sudden something comes up and hits you right between the eyes, I don't know what I was going to say. Just left me like that. Anyway, it's not easy. I never have said that this program was particularly easy, and yet I go right along with my husband on this thing that it's the only easy way of life that I've ever known. Life was pretty complicated before, pretty complicated. But this is an easy way to live. It's a joyous way to live, providing you can give the other fellow freedom. We call it release with love. Release with love. Now in the East they call it emotional detachment. Now both of these are good. I didn't used to like emotional detachment at all because it sounds so cold. But I can see how it would mean a great deal to certain people to detach yourself emotionally from a certain problem or a certain person. And yet, I like to put in with it the warmth of release with love. The thing that gives you the ability to leave every person free, to have the dignity of a human being. I like that word dignity because every human being has dignity, if you will allow it, because they are God's child. And even the drunk that is lying on the floor passed out cold and is as ugly as any person can be has dignity because inside, underneath, all that apparent crud is God's child and the person that he really is. But it's all covered up at the moment because he doesn't know. He doesn't yet know. So we can give every person dignity and we can give every person freedom to find their own answers in their own time, in their own way, without interference from us. We can even give them the freedom to be wrong and the right to make mistakes. Because I give myself the right to make mistakes today. I didn't used to. And if the easiest thing I do now is to be able to say, I sure made a boo-boo. I did a real nutty thing, you know. My head just plain isn't working today, you know. I've done a very stupid, asinine thing. Because that approval bit is not as necessary anymore, you see. And it's a funny thing how the other person takes it so easily and so graciously if we can say, you know, I made the doggone mistake today. And we don't have to put up a fancy picture of what we really are. We do this with our kids, you know. We put up a front with our kids that makes them think, yeah, my mother's perfect, at least she thinks she does, is. And then when they get a little older, they will look at us and look right through us and say, my mother is a hypocrite. I have heard young people say this. My mother is a hypocrite because she doesn't practice what she preaches. To the newcomer again, if you are as frustrated and as upset and as beside yourself as I was when my husband came to AA, I know exactly how you feel, and I know that we non-alcoholics have that same pain that the alcoholic has, that same churning in the stomach, that god-awful thing that just keeps going and won't quit, you know? And a lot of it is fear. A lot of it is fear. But I can promise you that if you will keep coming back to these meetings and listening to what these people say out of their own experience, the answers that they will suggest, if you will do what this program suggests, regardless of whether you're planning to divorce your alcoholic or whether you're planning to stay or you haven't made a decision if you're on the fence, it will eventually give you the courage to do one or the other, because you really only have two choices. You can stay and you can leave. Now, if you leave, even then you'd be wise to keep coming back to Al-Anon, because if you leave now, before you've gotten yourself straightened up, you may be very, very sorry you did. So the trick is, I think, to come to Al-Anon for long enough that you get your own self straightened out, your own thinking straightened out, so that you will be able then to make a decent decision. Because sometimes you jump from the frying pan into the fire. And I've seen it happen at least three times that I could name you right now, where a gal has jumped in and divorced her husband, and in a few months he's married somebody else. And then she is fit to be tied because she hadn't expected this, you see. And she's lost him and she's all upset and frustrated and beside herself. But if you have become pretty well yourself, then you can take off your rose-colored glasses and lay the thing right out cold turkey and take a look at both sides. What is going to happen if I stay here? What is going to happen and what is apt to happen if I leave, you see? And you can see just exactly what you're in for, the possibilities and all the rest. And you can decide either to accept this or to accept this and to let him go. Because you'll have to. Because you never know what he might do, you see? Because he might come across some gal that would say, oh, you poor dear. Isn't it a shame your wife doesn't understand you? And men just eat this up. Pardon me, sir, but it's the male that loves this thing, you know. They love it. We do too, and don't think we don't. We do too. But I'm going to wind this up now and let you have a coffee break. And this meeting isn't over until 2:30. So I think we'll either have a question meeting or a discussion meeting, whatever you want. I just want to end with one thing. I came into this program completely frozen inside. I couldn't feel. I just couldn't feel. I couldn't even feel anticipation. So I know that during those 6 years of church sobriety before Al-Anon, I thought I was comfortable. But I was just sort of, aw, you know? Everything was too easy. It was too easy. And it's a funny thing to be able to find out finally that you are an individual, that you are a person. And to get back your own personal integrity and your own feeling of worth. So that then no one, but no one, can tear you down unless you've really been wrong, and then maybe you can admit it and let it go and do better. But it's a wonderful thing when the love of the group and the love of the people begins to tear down that frozen inside of you so that you can feel again, and you no longer want to crawl under the table when somebody comes up and tells you, I love you. And you can't say, I love you back, because you feel like a hypocrite. And you wish you could, but you can't. And little by little, and gradually, day by day, it melts down. And pretty soon, you begin to be able to accept love. And when you can begin to accept love, then you can begin to give it. And pretty soon, you're just loving everybody to pieces, and everybody loves you, and everything's just lovely, and life is real great, real great. There's more love in this program than you will ever find anywhere else in the world. There's nothing like it anywhere else that I know of. Because it is a completely giving, sharing deal. We share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And we love each other. And it's just the greatest thing in the world. So I am eternally and forever grateful to this program for allowing me and teaching me how to become an individual again, how to be comfortable with me and with you, and how to love you. Thank you very much. I used to watch my husband and my stepfather argue at the dinner table so heatedly that I would end up in tears and have to leave the table because I thought they hated each other. But the truth of the matter was they both loved to argue, and regardless of which side my father would take, my husband would take the opposite side and vice versa. Just for the sake of argument. All right. Yeah. Okay. Don't let him do it with you.
You don't want to get involved.
State your point and let it go. And if he wants to argue, say, well, maybe you're right, but think about it. But don't continue it, because that's when you get in trouble. This has been my experience. Every one of these big rounds that Chuck and I have had was because I had to defend my position.
Okay. Elsa, I was going to mention that one of the things you've always said that helped me so very much, and I thought perhaps some of the other girls might like to hear you say, how if you had known better, you would have done better. You explained that so well, and I
touched on it. You see, I can see now that my obsession with the alcoholic caused me to neglect my children in areas that I should not have neglected them. I took care of all of their physical needs. They were well dressed, their clothes were clean, they had good food. I was mama and papa at all of the things that they performed in, or the games that they played, or anything else. But the thing is, the area that I neglected was my time. I never had time, nor the interest, nor the willingness to sit and listen to my children. And this is the big thing that comes out with the kids today. They say, my parents will not listen to me. We have no communication. And this seems to be the thing that's the matter with the whole world today. Nobody listens to anybody else. There's no communication. And was the area that I neglected so terribly, and the area that I had to forgive myself for, because I did not at the time know what I was doing. I did not realize what I was doing. Pardon me. And I had great guilt feelings afterwards when I began to see this, but I also had to see that I could not go on hurting like I hurt, because I had not done the right thing. I had to see that I had done the best I could according to what I knew at the time, and that today the only way I can make up for it and make amends is by becoming a better person today, a more understanding person, a person more willing to listen. It's the only way I can make up for it. It's too late to change that, you see. That's past, done, finished, and completed. And you can't change one minute of it.
Elsa, don't you think that we get so preoccupied with ourselves that we develop the ability to turn off?
Definitely.
Where others are concerned.
Yeah.
Right?
I remember I took Elsa Peace to a few Al-Anon meetings, and the subject was what effect did they have on the child, the alcohol, the drinking. And they asked Elsa Peace to talk, and I remember her saying, "I don't remember my daddy drinking," she said, "but I certainly remember my mother."
Mm-hmm.
And I could have killed her when I got outside, because I thought I was really being nice.
I thought I was a very good movie, everything
when he was out drinking. And I really thought I leaned over backwards for him until I heard it say that.
It's the love and the sharing and the companionship. I don't know why it is that we're so afraid to let people know how we really feel inside. And we think that we should be a tower of strength where our kids are concerned, you know, and that they must not think that we have any shortcomings, you know? But it's marvelous when a kid knows that you have trouble with a certain area, too, you know?
Look.
It seemed to me that I just couldn't wait for my kids to grow up and leave home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was asked on this, taking the children or going out, I have three sons, this is one going. We have outings this like summer, we water ski together, and oh, my husband's just great. I can't sit down on him, but he's fantastic in the summer. Oh, okay, now the winter and the Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts and these things, and he doesn't want to go. I go to all of them and all of our church things, and I'm the mother, father, image of these things, because I don't want them to go alone. Should I not go with them right
now? No, you should. You do the best you can, because they've got to have at least one parent there.
But I'm not saying shame on Daddy. I've learned that.
Oh, don't.
No, I used to say, well, that was a boy fella who'd rather be with him than come home. I mean, I've done that. Now I've learned, well, Daddy can make it tonight. I'd love to go with you.
Mm-hmm.
But I should go. You said, at this point, I didn't know.
Definitely. But the other areas that I neglected, it wasn't those areas I was very good at. But it was the companionship.
You have to watch this mother-father image, because I realize now that I was conning myself into this. It never once came to my mind to consider the fact that my husband was providing their clothing. My husband was providing the shelter that made it possible for me to be mother and father to these children.
So you would do
it. We have a question over here.
Well, my question is this. I am here. Yeah. things that you seen, you know, with our youngest son, and then he went away strong. So that left two of us. Well, we were always compatible, but Sam and I kind of started all this crazy through this job with.
Passed over the invisible line somewhere along in there.
But she developed new interest.
And he has her own always has like her something to come. It's always available.
That's right.
And
well, that's something over which you have absolutely no control, but I would suggest, just as Kay said here, that you need to develop new interest for yourself, because this is what I had to do after sobriety, because my husband is a very popular speaker and he's gone a great deal.
Well, my husband's gone.
Is he? Yeah. So I had to fill my life with something, and that was one of my reasons for starting the Monday group, was out of my own need, you see. But anything that you can get out of yourself doing, so that you won't be so lonely, you see, when you are at home, because you have many interests, you know?
Well, I don't have any interests right now, but when he does leave, then I leave. And I go and see friends.
Well, maybe you need to develop a few interests for yourself. See, this is a self-help program. This has nothing to do with him. It's for you.
I realize that.
Mm-hmm.
But I always leave.
You'd be surprised how good the house feels if you're only busy all day. Huh? Yeah.
Yeah? I just wanted to say that I can change myself back to that very time. I was never alone around that house. It was very alone.
Yeah, sure.
And it was terribly lonesome. And I started out going to parks so that I could shove the children in the swing and sit alone on the grass and be alone and lonely and miserable as I let myself be. And then I discovered these meetings. And I found that I could only eat 1 hour a week because of all the kids. And I could have made one, but I thought I could only make one. And I based my whole week around that meeting. Then I could fit two in. So I fit two and I gave my whole day for 2 days. I centered everything around getting to that meeting. And then I fit three in. And finally I worked it up to where I was really in a jiffy and I had to make almost one a day. But I would think you're in an ideal position to there are tens of meetings around here, and rather than be like I was, miserable and lonely all alone, you can, for no other reason, come to just go someplace, just to get out of the house and out of yourself to these meetings. They're all over the area, and if you have a car, it's and no responsibility, it's carting. I just have kids here and there and everywhere, and be back at a certain time, rush stuff, but I could just survive without these meetings. And that was when my husband was sharing. And I can remember, I didn't get any rest when he was home because I stand over and watch him sleep. him so it was just today that I was able to laugh when I was in all this commotion about the meeting today, and I was telling my husband it was a speaker, a leader, I don't know, something. I wish I didn't have this responsibility. And I said, you know, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have to go down. And he cracked up laughing. And he was just after all this, you know, we can laugh about things now. He knows that's silly. He knows I know whether he came or not. But it was really kind of refreshing that we worked up to that. It hasn't been that long.
Made me get out on my own and go to a few meetings on my own, and now I go to quite a few. If he shows, he shows. If he doesn't, he doesn't. I have somewhere to go, and I have something to do. I used to sit around and say, I have nothing to do. My house is clean at 9 o'clock. What's there to do? Now I'm sure if I get the house clean, you know, I've got somewhere to go, something to do, new interest, and find something for Nina to do, and I think it's going back making... Depending on my husband to make my day, or what's the word I'm looking for, to call me and say we're going to dinner, or we're going out of town, or for his, what is it, emotional security?
Sure.
I was dependent on him to make my fun or my unhappiness, and I've just learned that it isn't up to him to do that. It's up to me. And I can make that whole day. I can get up happy, and I can make my own day. I'm learning. This program is fantastic. I haven't attended that much, but it's just great.
It's a funny thing how self-pity comes out in so many guises that we don't recognize. And it all, if you'll look, take a real good, honest look at all of these uncomfortable feelings that we have, are 9 times out of 10 self-pity. Poor me. What have I done to deserve this? I'm not getting my just due. I'm not getting my proper respect. It's just expecting people to make us happy, make us comfortable. And they can't do it. It's an inside job. And it can't come from all this stuff out here.
Well, there's some times when I get to my friend, my friend to the house, and he is not, and he doesn't show up.
Oh, that's nice. But you see, there's where your light touch can come in again. Because when you have guests and your husband doesn't do what you think he ought to do, if you treat it lightly and let it go, your guest will be comfortable. But if you get upset, your guest will be upset, and you just watch it work. Same thing with your children. Same thing.
I think that's the time they let you down when you have an engagement.
Of course.
Have to be someplace at a certain time.
Or birthdays or anniversaries or any of these things that mean so much to us always seem to be the times that they do the thing the worst, you know?
I got real smart. I go to so many meetings here and getting a lot better. I just go ahead and get a sitter. And if he shows, I cancel a sitter. It's no big thing. I have 14 voices. A couple dollars and thank him very much. This way, if I say, honey, I've got some place to go tonight.
isn't going to show. I mean, I know that sometimes he will, but not most of the time. He's going to, or he'll be 5 minutes late. That's the time I was due for I was supposed to go. So now I have to learn that I have to plan my interview. That's no big thing either. It all worked out.
You can make a big thing out of anything. Let me say one thing. That the alcoholic is a tremendous leaner. They need a sense of security from you. I think this is one of the things that makes us maybe too strong in many areas. And we misuse our own strength, I think, in many cases. But let him call. It depends upon the attitude with which you receive it that makes the difference. If you just take it lightly and let it go, and not get all concerned and upset and tense and uptight.
Do you encourage her to call? No, it was pretty much just this week. I mean, she was with me last Sunday morning. After me, I said, I'm talking about this, and I'm not terrified. But he didn't know. But he called me, and my sister wasn't terrified. So he called her. She knew where I was going next, so then she called me and said, I'm going
to go to the church. She said, so then he called her Katie,
my mother, and I said, she's not a
woman.
So then
he
knew
he
got a friend
out there,
and
so he called
very this morning,
and he
said, I can't understand
if he makes it. No, I don't think that's it.
Not
a
love, but a illness.
No, I think if your husband is like my husband, he wanted me at home at any time that he chose to drop in or call.
On call.
Because
he totally changed later, either when he's sober. A couple of years ago, my husband and a friend went up north to visit some people. And both of my little girls were traveling in camp, and my two sons are here. It was the first time in 20 years I was free. I didn't have anybody I had to worry about. So I took off. I packed my suitcase and I took off to visit people. For 4 days, my husband tried to find me. And when he did, he's shooting me out up and down. And when he got back home, he said, if that ever happened again,
you should tell him to get an answering service.
Well, he had a secretary, but I didn't even know where I was going, because I thought, well, he's gone. I don't know where to get a hold of him. And I knew his girls were, and I called to check on him. Boys were in Europe. I didn't know what they were doing. And I just had this wonderful city feeling, and when he got back, he wanted me to feel guilty. I had to feel guilty because
I hope you didn't.
Well, now when I do go off, I tell the secretary where I'm going. I told him, if you want to get a hold of me again, just call him over. But I'm not going to feel guilty about it. Mm-hmm. I feel if he can go off and have this freedom, and which I
It would be quite a shock if you didn't happen to be there, wouldn't it?
I found that common courtesy helped a lot. rather than just going off without telling anyone where I'm going, if I have a plan, I'll say so. And I had a big problem with freeing myself from this mistaken sense of responsibility. You see, I like to think that the alcoholic has a problem with drinking, and I, as a non-alcoholic, have a problem with thinking. And my mind was completely obsessed at all times with where is he? What's he doing? Is he going to be home for dinner? Should I? What time is he going to get there? Should I be there ahead of him? And so forth and so on. And I had to take a deliberate stand on this to help myself. And this is the way I did it. And it sounds very silly, but it worked. I dedicated one day of the week to be kind to Margaret Day. And I let everybody in the family know, and my friends also knew, that Wednesday was be kind to Margaret Day. And this was the day when I wasn't going to think about all those other people and what they were doing, but I was going to go and try to enjoy just living and do things that I had wanted to do, but I'd always been afraid to take the time to do, because I was needed so many places. You see, after taking the fourth and fifth step, I got to the tenth step, and then I realized that one of my biggest problems was that I had an excessive need to be needed. I think this is just given to living, to its common courtesy. If you have a plan, say so. It's communication.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's vindictive.
Right.
You go away, so I'll go away.
It's getting even. But you see, in a way, you're playing the same game, because you're getting even too by letting him worry about where you are.